This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And now it's time for our Random Acts of Kindness segment. You can find all sorts of these uplifting stories all over this great country and at randomactsofkindness.org. It's an inspiring resource and a great one to share with your kids. And also make sure to leave your story there. Our first story is from Memphis, where we found some kind cops and a young man with a very clear sense of priorities.
It's a heartwarming video, already viewed thousands of times. Memphis police officers brightening the holidays for an 11-year-old burglary victim. Tonight, the officers are talking about going beyond the call of duty. WMC Action News 5's Jason Miles live tonight with their response. Jason?
Those officers work here at the Crump Station Police Precinct. They hope what they did inspires others this holiday season.
You see on the news what Memphis police often encounter while on the job.
Oh, no.
11-year-old Tontravian Campbell is proof that it's not all bad. Officers replaced the Xbox stolen during a burglary at his family's home.
When we asked the child if he's going to get a new Xbox for Christmas, he said, no, my mom doesn't have that kind of money, and all the money she makes goes to pay the bills.
Officers from Crump Station's Charlie Shift talked to us about the gesture, which went viral Sunday thanks to this Facebook video.
This house was burglarized not too long ago, today, while these folks was at church.
They say Tontravian was more concerned about his mother than the stolen Xbox, which is what impressed them the most.
Just to be able to alleviate some of his stress just for that day and actually help their family in this time, like Christmas, it really was an overwhelming feeling.
Tontravian actually posted a comment on the WMC Action News 5 Facebook page, writing in part, quote, "Am so thankful." His mother added, quote, "I'm truly grateful for the generosity that was given to my son."
Policing is not really about just going into dangerous situations. It's definitely about helping out the community as well.
No problem, man. You deserve it, man.
Something one 11-year-old found out firsthand.
And officers bought that new Xbox and three games at the GameStop store in Midtown. The store donated an additional controller. Reporting live from the Crump Station Precinct, Jason Miles, WMC Action News 5.
And our second story comes from CBS's Steve Hartman, who meets some of the most interesting and some of the kindest people in this country.
For a deaf person like Ibi Paracha of Leesburg, Virginia, getting the drink you want at Starbucks can be a tall order. But Ibi says not here, thanks to a barista who recently did something truly grande.
When I came in, the first thing she did was she wrote the note. So I thought maybe she had a question for me or something. But it really wasn't a question at all. And as I read through it, it shocked me.
He immediately posted this picture of the note, which read, "I've been learning ASL, American Sign Language, just so you can have the same experience as everyone else."
What can I get for you today?
That barista is Crystal Payne.
Two Trenta iced coffees.
She's new here. In fact, she'd only waited on Ibi once before deciding to go home, go on the internet, and learn sign language for him.
Maybe I spent like 3 or more hours on it.
Getting ready to take one order?
Yeah. If he's a regular and I want to make that connection with my regulars, I should be able to at least ask him what he wants to drink. What you want drink?
Today, Crystal knows everything she needs to wait on Ibi.
Caramel frappuccino, please.
And that really is the extent of their interaction. To Crystal, it's no big deal. But to Ibi, who says navigating a hearing world is often frustrating, what Crystal did was a wonderful gesture that he will never forget. He even saved the note.
It's something that was very inspirational, so I wanted to keep it in a frame.
Sometimes customer service gets a bad rap, and it's often well-deserved.
Hi, what can I get for you today?
But there are those frontline workers who go above and beyond, not for a tip or because the boss is watching, but because kindness is who they are, and the customer, all they care about.
And it's just something that really gave me genuine happiness.
Even now?
Yeah, even now, still smiling.
And finally, here's a story about how regularly ordering a pizza saved a man's life.
In the middle of a very busy Saturday night, the staff at this Domino's Pizza on Silverton Road realized that they hadn't gotten an order from one of their favorite customers in almost 2 weeks. So they went to check on him, and sure enough, he was having a medical emergency.
So we always order online, so it pretty much just comes up on our main line.
Every couple days, Sarah Fuller's staff gets an order from one of their regulars, 48-year-old Kirk Alexander. But over the weekend, it dawned on everyone that they hadn't seen Alexander's name pop up for a long time.
A couple different people had pointed it out to me, and so Saturday night was when I finally decided to look up to see when his last order, what happened to be, and it was 11 days ago, which is not normal at all.
Sarah sent a delivery driver to Alexander's house, and something was clearly wrong.
He called us back and said that, you know, he knocked and heard the TV, but he didn't have an answer, and so we gave him his phone number, and then he tried to call.
The staff called 911, and when deputies arrived, they heard Alexander inside yelling for help. They forced their way in and found him on the floor having a medical emergency.
I bang on the door, but he doesn't always answer.
Neighbor Robert Lalonde knows that Alexander's had health problems, so he keeps an eye on him, too. He was also worried that something was wrong, so he's grateful that Domino's stepped in.
That's awesome. That is awesome. You know, most people just take it for granted.
Yeah,
and that's really cool.
These Domino's employees are always on the move, trying to make and deliver food fast. But they say they're never too busy to help someone in need.
We're always looking out for everyone out there and caring for our customers especially.
And early yesterday morning, paramedics responded with deputies as well. They rushed Alexander to Salem Hospital, and he is still there tonight in fair condition. Live in Salem, Jamie Wilson, Fox 12, Oregon.
And there you have it. From all around this great country, from coast to coast, it's constantly happening. You just never hear about it. But here on Our American Stories, we do it every week. Random Acts of Kindness. And you can go to randomactsofkindness.org. Look for stories like this. Better still, post your stories there. And go to ouramericannetwork.org to catch all of our stories and all of our Random Acts of Kindness. More after these messages. This is Our American Stories, and you're listening to Stevie Ray Vaughan, and it's time for our regular Final Thoughts segment. One day I think we're just going to play a song for a Final Thoughts segment, and it's going to be Tears in Heaven, because I think that was actually Eric Clapton's final thoughts, not only for his son, but a musician whom he'd grown very close to after he had sobered up, because Clapton had suffered through his own addictions, heroin addiction, and so too did Stevie Ray Vaughan, whom you're listening to now, and who had just come in with that great guitar riff and opening from In Step, Stevie's best record. He had just recorded his best record. He was out touring the country. I had never seen him better, never seen him more sober. And then he dies in a tragic accident. And today, we're going to be doing our Final Thoughts segment featuring Rick Cleveland, a writer from Oxford, and the Oxford Eagle, a newspaper in town where we broadcast from, and that's Oxford, Mississippi. And by the way, again, Final Thoughts is when we hear from people who are dying, but also Final Thoughts from folks who want to express themselves about their loved ones. A eulogy, a written tribute, anything that stirs them and can stir you. And again, if you have a final thought that you want to share with us, or final thoughts about a loved one, 844-627-8255 is where you can leave it and record it. and we'll fix it up and put it on air. And don't worry about what you sound like, folks. This one just has to come from the heart. That's all. And don't worry too much about your grammar. We don't care. And now let's listen to Rick Cleveland. And this is a tribute he wrote in the paper for his dear friend who had passed away.
My old and good friend Nick Kolinsky, a patriot if ever there was one, died on July 5th, 2016, a day after his 77th Independence Day on this earth. Nick was an Army veteran who loved his country and the men and women who fought for it. But he was much more than that, as we will see. He was a football star, a square-jawed, bull-strong lineman on a national championship team at Southern Miss in 1962. A Pennsylvania native, Nick learned about USM when he was in the Army and drinking beer with some other soldiers in a German beer hall. One of them had attended USM and just raved about it. Nick decided right then and there he was going to go to college in that funny named town of Hattiesburg. And that's just what he did. When he left Pennsylvania, he told his mama he was headed to Mississippi. Her reply, "Son, that's a river, isn't it?" When he got to Hattiesburg, Nick walked unannounced into Hall of Fame football coach Pye Van's office. "My name is Nick Kolinsky, and I want to play football for you," he told Van. Van gave him a tryout and then quickly a scholarship. Nick flourished at USM, and he never left Hattiesburg. He was an entrepreneur, a tavern owner who also ran a moving business. He was a devout Catholic, a family man, a husband, a father, a grandfather, and then a great-grandfather. He was a Hattiesburg icon, possessing remarkable spirit, energy, and work ethic. He was an emotional guy who laughed and cried often, with no apologies for the latter. He was a doer. If you were Nick's friend, he would do anything for you. If you were a stranger, he'd do anything for you anyway. Which brings us to today's story. In 1981, Jack Lucas was a stranger. One day, after work, Nick was watching TV.
"That's but one objective.
Color I see.
Shut
that
up.
You maintain the status."
December 7th, night.
Flipping channels until he saw a CBS News program with images of the Battle of Iwo Jima in World War II. Nick was hooked. The program told the Jack Lucas story, how Lucas from North Carolina had lied about his age at 14 to join the U.S. Marines.
"Thank goodness I didn't have to go in the first wave, but when we went in, it was all hell broke loose."
How on February 20, 1945, 6 days after his 17th birthday, Lucas hurled his body onto two enemy grenades, saving the lives of three fellow Marines.
"When I reached down to unjam a rifle, I saw two grenades. So I hollered grenades and dove for the grenades and covered them with my body."
Lucas somehow survived the grenades with shrapnel throughout his body. Lucas became the youngest ever to win the Congressional Medal of Honor, which was pinned on him by President Harry S. Truman. But the program also told how Lucas had fallen on hard times, was living in a meat locker in Maryland on a $200 a month stipend from the government. Because of IRS problems, all other government benefits were garnished. Nick Kolinsky was horrified. He could not believe his country would let this happen to such a patriot, such a hero. Nick cried himself to sleep that night and awakened in tears the next morning. Said his wife, Carol, "Well, Nick, do something about it." So Nick called the CBS affiliate in Mobile and was told he should call the national network. He did so, and was so insistent he was finally given the phone number of the program's producer. Nick convinced the producer all he wanted to do was help Lucas, and the producer gave Nick a phone number. It took him several tries, but Nick finally got Lucas on the phone. They talked and hit it off. Several more phone calls ensued. Nick also made another call to the late U.S. Representative Sonny Montgomery, a champion of military veterans. Within weeks, Lucas was restored to full benefits. That wasn't enough for Nick, who knew Lucas was lonely. So he invited Lucas for a visit to Hattiesburg, and then he offered him a place to live and a family, his family, Nick and Carol and their four children. Nick and Carol Kolinsky's daughter, Kim Kolinsky, became particularly close to Jack Lucas, like the daughter he had never had. "I don't have much to offer you, but I can offer you a family," Nick told Lucas. And that's the way it went down. Eventually, Lucas bought his own home in Hattiesburg, and just as Nick Kolinsky, he never left. In the Hub City, Lucas met and married his wife, Ruby. His final years were happy ones. More than 63 years after his act of heroism, Jack Lucas died on June 15, 2008. The section of U.S. 49 Highway between Wiggins and Hattiesburg is now known as the Jack Lucas Medal of Honor Memorial Highway. 8 years and a few days later, after Jack Lucas's death, Nick Kolinsky passed away, leaving behind untold numbers of friends and admirers, and also leaving his adopted home, Hattiesburg, a far better place. Legions of friends attended Nick's funeral last week. Appropriately, there was at least one stranger. "I never knew this man, Nick Kolinsky," the man from Mobile told the family. "I am here to pay respects to Nick Kolinsky because of what he did for Jack Lucas."
And what a great story. Great job by the whole team here. And thank you, Rick Cleveland, for telling that story about Nick Kolinsky. It doesn't get better than that, folks. And there are so many stories like this across this country. And we like to bring them to you here on Our American Stories. And you can go to OurAmericanNetwork.org and listen to our final thought segments. We have a bunch of favorites. Tony Dolan's. He was the chief speechwriter for Ronald Reagan. His story about his dad, oh my goodness, his eulogy. Brooke Eason talking about his father, Paul. And the World War II vet recalling the Silent Night, the singing of Silent Night. It doesn't get better than this as storytelling. And we just get out of the way, as you can tell, and let the storytellers tell their stories. And this is Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib. More after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And the subject for this segment, well, actually, we just heard it a couple of times right there in that piece by Stevie Ray Vaughan. He had a nice, well, pause right there. And we've been pushing around this piece for, I don't know, since it seems like last year, in praise of the one-second pause, which Hengler worked up. And, well, we're going to resuscitate it, because it seems like it's already been buried. And when we went to Hengler and said, "Hey, I think we should do that one-second pause," now he went, "What? You're serious. We're not going to really do it, are we?" And we really are. And, well, before we do, I just wanted to talk a little bit about why pauses matter in literature. And I don't know if you remember your class way back, if you ever took a poetry class or a writing class, but the caesura is one of the most important literary devices there is in poetry. And, well, what it means, well, here's the actual definition from the Poetry Archive. A caesura is a strong pause within a line and is often found alongside an enjambment. If all the pauses in the sense of the poem were to occur at the line breaks, this could become dull. Moving the pauses so they occur within the line creates musical interest. A caesura may be marked like this, and then you'll see two straight lines next to each other. So when you're reading a poem and you see that, that means shut up, basically. Shut up. Two lines. John Mole's Coming Home has a first stanza that sets off in a very steady rhythm with the first four sentences the same length as the line and the same length as each other. The fifth sentence is only half a line long, and the pause following that full stop creates a really dramatic caesura. So again, where and how to use pauses. And by the way, musicians, great ones, especially as they get older. Listen to B.B. King play when he was young. Listen to him play when he was older. And I say the same for my dear and most beloved guitarist and my personal favorite, Stevie Ray Vaughan. Listen to him play when he was young, up and down the fret like a madman. Older, sometimes he'd just shut up. Hardest thing to do sometimes. By the way, all over the Bible, you'll see the same thing, called something different. And I'm holding in my hand Psalm 3. Save me, O my God. That's one of the Psalms of David when he fled from Absalom with his son. O Lord, how many are my foes? Many are rising against me. Many are saying of my soul, there is no salvation from him in God. Caesura. I'm supposed to shut up now. But you, O Lord, are a shield about me, my glory and the lifter of my head. I cried aloud to the Lord, and he answered me from his holy hill. Caesura. So on and so forth. So now on to Hengler's In Praise of the 1 Second Pause. And, well, we're going to be talking to someone, or Greg did, named Marty Nemko, who holds a PhD in education from the University of California, Berkeley. He is in his 26th year as a host of a national public radio San Francisco radio show, and Marty recently wrote a piece for Psychology Today entitled In Praise of the 1 Second Pause. He began his piece asking these questions.
How do you feel when someone interrupts you? Very few people like it. Well, this question is harder. How do you feel when someone starts to talk the nanosecond you finish saying something? Chances are you don't like that either. After all, that suggests that the person was more interested in saying something than in digesting what you said. Or maybe the person stopped paying attention and was just waiting for you to finish. Now, in contrast, imagine that you finished saying something and the person took a full second to think. Maybe saying, now how are you feeling? You're probably feeling the person thought your statement was worth pondering and more foundational, that you were taken seriously, which we all want.
Well, we had Our American Stories' Greg Hengler ask Marty, what would we say to someone who just likes to talk and never takes that breath? Or how would we respond to somebody who consistently interrupts us? Here's Marty's answer.
It's very difficult to change people, but I am a big believer in giving tactfully dispensed unwanted advice. So if somebody really is interrupting me all the time, I would, in a very tactful and simple way, say, I really'd like to finish. And if you watch CNN or you watch any kind of TV or radio show, you'll see that the experienced guests who are on panels, if there is one of their panelists is interrupting all the time, they'll say something like, I allowed you to finish, please allow me. And do that in that very calm way. You pay a price no matter what. You pay a price if you ignore it. But you pay a bigger price if you're constantly ignored. And again, it depends on the situation. If you're getting interviewed for a job, I'm not sure you're going to want to interrupt the interviewer and say, to just totally interrupt, would you please stop interrupting me? Yeah. But in more common situations where the risk-reward ratio is better, it may be worth offering a bit of gentle feedback.
We know a man who adheres to a four-sentence rule. This involves speaking approximately four sentences and then waiting to see if the listener wants to hear more. He does this because we often say more than our listener wants to hear. Is this rule basically a different take compared to your one-second pause suggestion?
It's a very different rule, and I find that too rigid. That's the rule of how long you should talk. I'm much more in favor of what I call the traffic light rule. During the first 30 seconds of an utterance, your light is green. The person is paying attention, not overwhelmed with content. During the second 30 seconds of an utterance, your light is yellow. There's an increased chance that the person is wishing you would stop, or indeed has something that he or she wants to say. At the 60-second mark, you occasionally want to run a red light, which is, but usually you want to stop. So I think that gives a little more flexibility than four sentences, because sometimes things take less than four sentences and sometimes more.
Boy, these are really good rules to live by, actually. Never really thought about that before. I think I've got like a 9-minute rule. I got to really work on this, man. Here's Marty on a pet peeve he has involving conversation.
Narcissism. Normally in a conversation, it is like a ping pong game. You want to spend roughly half the time with the ball in your court. Roughly, it's more like 40 to 60% in a conversation. And very many people violate the rule in either direction. They're either narcissistic and they will talk about 80 or 90% of the time and never ask a question about you. Or if they do, it's obligatory, and then they're really not paying attention. They're only half listening. Or on the other hand, of course, there are people who have difficulty speaking up and who talk 10 to 20% of the time. So a nice rule of thumb is to go for roughly 40 to 60% of the time using the traffic light rule and using the 1 second pause. But I would be full of BS if I said that was very easy to change. It is very difficult to change a natural habit of interrupting, talking at too great length, and not pausing.
Well, so far we have chose to cut out Greg's question to Marty. But for this one, we will be including Greg's question because it's a personal one. But wait for it. So is Marty's answer.
I don't necessarily consider myself a narcissist, but I know that I struggle with returning the favor when somebody asks me a question. You know, how was your day? What did you do this weekend? A lot of times I'll give them an answer and then I won't say, well, how was yours? And then I walk away and I can, it's usually 4 or 5 minutes later, I'm like, oh man, I did it again. I didn't ask them. And I just must come off as just selfish.
Yeah, well, that's what the narcissist thing is about. It becomes not high enough priority that while you count, so does your conversation partner.
Ouch. That stung. Greg asked for some clarity.
So I fall into the narcissist's category.
Well, it's too strong. I mean, okay. You're way ahead of the game because you're concerned about it. You're aware about it. You're in that interim transition period from when you are unaware and just oblivious and continuing to blather on and a full conversation partner. So I would bet that you will do fine. You're just in that transition period. You're not a narcissist.
There you go, folks. None of us here have perfected the art of dialogue. And thought this would be a piece of advice we could all put in our back pocket and actually use in praise of the 1 second pause. And don't forget, 30 seconds green light, 45 seconds yellow light. You go past a minute and don't let the other guy talk, you got a problem. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories.
This is Our American Stories, and today we're playing our favorite segments featuring Mike Rowe. Today marks his 54th birthday. Here's Lee Habib.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And today is First Job Fridays. We love talking about first jobs. What was yours? We talk to famous people, not so famous people. And we are of the deep belief that the younger you get your kids to work, the better. And work is good. And so before we do anything, you know, one of our favorite clips, and we had played it once before about 6 months ago, was Ashton Kutcher. Is that right, Greg? Did I say that right? Kutcher?
Yeah.
Is that okay? Okay.
I just like the over-exaggerated. Kutcher.
Kutcher. Well, Ashton Kutcher was giving a speech, and you know, you were expecting, I think, A from him, something fluffy, something silly. But he was there to talk about life to a bunch of graduates, and here's what he said instead. And I don't think anyone was expecting this, and I learned a lot about the guy with this particular clip. Roll it, Jesse.
When I was 13, I had my first job with my dad carrying shingles up to the roof. And then I got a job washing dishes at a restaurant. And then I got a job in a grocery store deli. And then I got a job in a factory sweeping Cheerio dust off the ground. And I've never had a job in my life that I was better than. I was always just lucky to have a job. And every job I had was a stepping stone to my next job. And I never quit my job until I had my next job. And so opportunities look a lot like work.
Opportunities look a lot like work. And by the way, yep, that's right. I have my own groupies just like Ashton, too. Keep it down, ladies. Keep it down. Well, earlier this year, I got a chance to talk to Mike Rowe, who you heard in the last segment, about his first job. And, well, here's what Mike had to say.
Tell the audience what your first job was, Mike.
Look, I mean, honestly, I'm driving over. I'm in a recording studio right now. And on my way here, I was really honestly trying to recall the first time I actually got a paycheck. Not paid, but an actual paycheck. And as near as I can remember it, it was by United Artists, where I was working as an usher in high school in one of the first multiplex theaters in a mall back in 1978. Black pants, red jacket, white shirt, terrible velvety black bow tie.
Oh, what an ugly image, Mike. Stop now, please.
Look, I worked my way up to the sewer, but you had to start somewhere.
That's true. Well, we talk next about hard work and lessons most Americans learn from their first jobs.
The point of this First Jobs Fridays is the work ethic and what's happened to it in America and how do we reinforce it? How do we reward it? And you tell the story. I saw a TED talk you gave a couple of years ago, Mike, and you were quoting Aristotle. I mean, the guy who snippets bull testicles was also quoting Aristotle, but this caught my attention. You had recalled seeing a poster and it was in a guidance counselor's office of all places, and it said, work smart, not hard. And what did you do to that poster, work smart, not hard?
Well, it took me 35 years to getting around to defacing it, which was what I wanted to do the first time I saw it. But that moment, and look, high school kids are going through this right now as we speak. I was summoned to Mr. Dunbar's office to discuss my future. He was arguing persuasively for a four-year degree, and I was open to it. I just didn't have any money, and I didn't know what I wanted to do, so I told him that a two-year school seemed more affordable and more likely, at which point he pointed to this poster, and the images on the poster, it was split down the middle. On the left is a kid holding a college degree, looking hopeful and optimistically toward the future. On the right is a mechanic, head down, covered in crap, or something worse, holding a wrench, looking like he just won the vocational consolation prize of all time. And it was the caption, though, Lee, honestly, work smart, not hard. It was the first time I had seen it. And that poster and that sentiment in the late 70s was actually part of a larger PR campaign designed to get kids excited about higher education. Unfortunately, it came at the expense of all other forms of education. And my own personal theory, for what it's worth, is that our country has taken that advice. If you Google work smart, not hard right now, you'll see hundreds of pages. It's a platitude that has inculcated itself deep into the country's brainstem. And it's a false choice. You know, work smart and hard. Last year, I did a campaign with Caterpillar around a work ethic issue, around a recruitment issue, and I recreated the poster, and I crossed out not, and I scratched in and we've since sold a few thousand of them, and now they're hanging in high schools around the country, which makes me feel smug and important.
And that's a unique voice, and we're going to be sharing more of that. You know, we're close to the former Secretary of Education, Bill Bennett. And his latest book, Is College Necessary, is ripping it up and ripped it up on the New York Times bestseller list because a lot of families are starting to think, is it necessary? I mean, if you want to go work at Microsoft and be a code writer, it's not. And in fact, we learned from Michael Kalertner who is a tech entrepreneur, that those are the worst code writers, the ones from colleges, because they're taught by professors who haven't written code in 20 years. And it's the people who are teaching themselves online, and, well, go figure. And why aren't there more places to learn that and then go get a job? And by the way, the pay for those coders, we're all sitting here stupefied at how much good code writers can make. And it was hundreds of thousands of dollars. Hundreds. Mike has also spoken publicly about his brother's first job, a brother who was also a Boy Scout. Here's Mike again.
One night at home, I was probably 21 in college. Scott would have been about 17, maybe. And Scott comes in. He had his first job. He was working as a lifeguard over at that apartment complex in Middle River. Right? We're sitting down at dinner, and there were no sausage and no eggs. I don't know what Mom made, like a meatloaf casserole or something. We were super inventive that night. But we're eating, and we're sitting there, and Scott walks in. How was your day? Scott gives his typical meaningful dinner conversation. And about halfway through dinner, my mother says, no, really, tell us about your job. You know, and he's working at a lifeguard at a pool. And he said, yeah, you know, it was a pretty good day. It was kind of interesting. I saved a guy's life. Pass the salt over there. What do you mean? Like, you what? He goes, I was standing up on my seat, and I looked down, and this guy was swimming in the deep end on the bottom of the pool doing this. And then, but he wasn't moving. And then he wasn't doing this. And so I dove in. He was a big guy, and I got him to the surface, and some people helped me. We rolled him out, and you know, I did some of this, and the water came out of his mouth, and he coughed, and then he got up and shook my hand and walked away. And anyway, this meatloaf is delicious, Mom. And we're like, huh. And so as I'm sitting here with the sausage and the eggs and looking at my brother, who's a star scout, who saved a guy's life. You know, Scott doesn't have a TV show in 180 countries. He doesn't have... He didn't have one of these. The son of a gun saved a guy's life. So you win.
And by the way, that's the second time tonight we've heard about a Boy Scout doing a heroic act and being humble about it. That's the thing, being humble about it. And these stories are everywhere. And because these boys are so humble, we just never hear about them. And so our field correspondent, John Woods, who gave that great interview earlier with the prize-winning writer on the Scouts, is with us right now. And, John, I thought I'd ask you about your first job. And, by the way, I didn't learn about you being an Eagle Scout. I've known you, what, 4 or 5 years, John? And I just find out last week that you were an Eagle Scout. What was that first job? What did you learn? And how did it help you get where you are today, John Woods?
So my first job, I'll preface this with saying that my mother was a very hard worker and left home at 17 and had been responsible for herself ever since. And so she believed in working at a young age. So when I was in seventh grade, I started working for her. She's a corporate meeting planner. So when businesses either come to our hometown of Memphis or sometimes she would go elsewhere across the country or the world with them, I would go with her. And my first job involved everything from being the guy that held the sign that says, you know, Mr. So-and-so at the airport, you know, this way to your car, to running, coffee urns outside the hotel ballroom at an event, or helping some guy find the nearest bar. So I learned at a very young age how to get along with people from across the country.
Yeah, and work taught you that. You have a funny story about your first job, John?
Yeah, actually. So one of the jobs I went with my mother, I think I was in seventh or eighth grade at the time, was one of the first things I ever did. We went to Bermuda, the small island in the middle of the Atlantic. She was working for a company which had just hired George Foreman, the famous Olympic boxer, heavyweight boxer. And my job was to stand in line and to hold people's beers at this event and sort of handle the line to go up and see George. Meet him, shake his hand, that kind of stuff. Well, part of my job was to wear a loud Bermuda shirt. You know, they're in Bermuda, they're known for their shorts, but I was wearing their shirt. It had lots of frogs on it, brightly colored, and I looked like a complete idiot. And this one guy was trying to tip me for holding his beer. And he says, and it's a $20, $20. And he says, hey, you know, kid, take this for my drink. I was like, no, sir, I can't accept it. And he says, you know, seriously, take it. I was like, no, really, sir, I can't accept it. And in front of George Foreman, who I had had a poster of this guy in my room for 3 or 4 years, and he says, in front of George Foreman, it's like, no, kid, seriously, take this $20, go buy yourself a new shirt. You really need it. Everyone in line starts laughing. George Foreman's laughing at me. And here I am, like, this red, white, red and yellow, orange-colored shirt. And my face just went as dark as the red on the shirt. And I was mortified in front of, you know, this 250, 6'5" boxer. So embarrassed. I think I, like, went straight up to my hotel room and changed shirts immediately after that.
Well, lesson,
I might have never understood
lesson learned, and you learned how to laugh at yourself in the end, John. John, thanks for the great reporting, and we'll get in touch with you soon.
All right, have a good one.
You bet. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. First Job Friday. More after this. One that was long and black. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we love to talk about music, we love to talk about race and class, but in a way you've never heard anywhere else. And we love to talk about this a unique experience and this unique thing we call music. Music touches us in ways we don't know, and I wanted to tell the story today about Robert Plant, the lead singer of Led Zeppelin. We had told it before, and we want to tell it again, and Robert Plant, of course, was the lead singer for Led Zeppelin. He fell in love with music because, well, he fell in love with the black experience. And the black experience manifested itself through and in music in this great country. And it went all across the way to the pond, and that is the Atlantic Ocean. And Robert Plant fell in love with music first and first only with the blues music of the Delta. And so we bring you this story about Robert Plant and his connection to America's story. The band, Led Zeppelin. The voice, Robert Plant's.
I can't quit you, babe. So I'm gonna put you down for a while. I said, I can't quit you, babe. I guess I got to put you down.
Though British, Led Zeppelin's music was rooted in the American South and blues specifically. That's Robert Plant, Jimmy Page, John Paul Jones, and John Bonham's take on the great Willie Dixon classic, and it appeared on their very first record. The band formed in 1968, made only 9 studio recordings, all of which made it to the top 10 on the Billboard charts, and they sold, get this, 110 million records. The band suffered a huge setback, though, when their drummer, John Bonham, died, and it wasn't long before the band died. They called it quits in 1980. Robert Plant soon found himself out of a job as the lead singer of the world's biggest band. And my goodness, he had no idea what to do next. He talked about the next steps in his journey as an artist.
And you, when I was 32 and Led Zeppelin finished, and I was just standing there going, wow, I suppose that's a lot then, you know. I better do a bit of dry stone walling or something like that, you know. How about being a steeplejack, you know, or if I like the heights. So I was always sort of wobbling around.
Like a lot of artists, wobbling around, Plant spoke about the music that inspired him, the music that drove Zeppelin and also the Rolling Stones, their compatriots, and so many other, well, British boys.
When I was a kid, I was like so many people of my generation. We were really moved by the deep soul of black American music from Mississippi, from moving, you know, with development and industry up into Chicago and Detroit, down to New Orleans, where nothing really, it was another world. It wasn't even America. But British kids of my age really were so transfixed by the change and by the dynamic of a black culture that we really, really were, these guys became instant heroes. They may have been unsavory, they may have been unlucky, they may have been hellhounds, they could have been anything, but basically there was a lure to the music of the black American which kept us going, the Yardbirds, you know, the Stones, Led Zeppelin.
As time passed and Plant continued to explore different musical styles, he returned again to the American South. This is about the year 2000. But instead of blues music being the inspiration, he rediscovered the roots music he grew up with in England, the songs and music that also inspired country and folk music here. It's known as Americana. Here is Plant talking about that music.
Happened to me later was I found that there was more stuff underneath the covers going on, and it was still coming from Ireland and places in Tennessee and in the mountains where people just hadn't moved on. Families lived there for five generations without shifting from one township, so the music followed down through the families, and we got really old songs there.
Well, after multiple Grammys with Alison Krauss, Plant described the band he formed in 2010, a band with Buddy Miller, Daryl Scott, Patty Griffin, among others. He'd traveled a long way, Plant, a long way from those electrified sounds of Led Zeppelin and one singer leading a band.
There's loads of ways of skinning a cat, really, and I just think that this Band of Joy here is, there are six voices on this. So sometimes when we hit something like Gallows Pole, it is virtually entirely, apart from a banjo intro, it's a cappella, and it kicks like you wouldn't believe.
This is Lee Habib. You're listening to Our American Stories. When we come back, we will continue with this remarkable story about a man, a British man, who comes to America to discover his own roots, not once, but twice. We'll be back in just a few.
Couldn't get no cold. You know that we're too dead bold. Keep you from the gallows pole. You know that we're too dead bold. Keep you from the gallows pole.
There's loads of ways of skinning a cat, really, and I just think that this Band of Joy here is, there are six voices on this. So sometimes when we hit something like Gallows Pole, it is virtually entirely, apart from a banjo intro, it's a cappella, and it kicks like you wouldn't believe.
And boy, does it kick.
You get a little gold. What did you bring me, my brother, to keep me from the gallows pole?
Clint went on to discuss his life as an artist. And by the way, artists' life are not always easy. Great success followed by barren periods. And my goodness, the 80s and 90s were barren periods for Robert Plant. Don't go back and listen to that discography. It's not pretty. But he was experimenting, and he wanted to go anew. In fact, at one point during this interview, he said, "What I did not want to do again was become a Robert Plant cover band. There were too many better ones than me." So struggling for the new identity that matched where he was in his life is always the artist's struggle, not to do the same thing again over and over. So Plant discussed his life as an artist and the detours, contours, that made and still make his life as an artist so compelling.
It's been a very strange navigational game, this, which I've enjoyed. I mean, sometimes the shadows that come behind me are a little bit bigger than I need them to be, but it's been great fun. So I've rejected it, I've turned my back on it, and I can't be any of the guys I ever was before, you know? I mean, you've got to evolve is the only way to get through. So, you know, just give me bigger maps.
Just give me bigger maps. And again, the map became the United States. Appalachian music, the hill country music of North Carolina, Virginia, straight down to the roots music of some of his early idols. But in particular, Nashville, which is where he ended up living for a while. Plant never saw himself, we learn in this particular interview, as a great singer. By the way, we'll learn as we profile Billie Holiday in a couple of months that she never saw herself as a great singer. She had wished she had the chops of a Sarah Vaughan. But as Plant points out here, it's precisely because he didn't have those chops that perhaps he brought something else to the table. His real talent? Having the ability to get under the skin of a song and, well, bring it to life.
I just get into songs and live them out, which is a different thing, you know. And I think that's true. If everything else I said wasn't true, that's really true.
That's really true. You know, Jesse, is there a Zeppelin song that's yours? Is there one that
hits you? Oh, it's a bit on the nose, but Stairway to Heaven's always been a killer.
Yep, it's been, I think, a killer for everybody. I think in every single rock and roll countdown around the country, it's always the number one song.
Definitely.
And it's what? How many years later? 1977, 76?
Before my time.
Yeah, and I've noticed also, Jesse, that you go around and you see, and I live in a great college town. We're in Oxford, Mississippi. And you talk to young people, and Kanye West, Stairway to Heaven, right next to each other on an iPod.
Ugh.
And that's something that's really remarkable about how people are transmitting and gathering their music. It's not categories anymore like when we were kids. Well, here is Plant in a concert performed in 2010 for the BBC. It was with his Band of Joy. He tells a story here about the song he ended this great concert with. A concert, by the way, you can watch by simply Googling the words Band of Joy and BBC. It's an hour-long, precious, precious piece of music. Put it on a big screen TV, invite some friends. Well, it's like you're going to a great new concert you never saw before. And by the way, we love doing that here on Our American Stories. Because when you bump into something new that was old, it's new to you. And we're not going to do the news here every night. Because most of what's in the news is, well, nonsense. It's not anything that anyone cares about. Folks just have to fill up the news. And I think if you look carefully at CNN's ratings and Fox's, they don't hold a candle to anything that's on mainstream television or radio. So here's that song that we were talking about. And it's a beautiful example of Plant, quote, living out a song, along with some other extraordinary singers.
Now, you know, I finally got my way after so many thousands of years of saying, why don't you finish the show with a song that says everything? And I tried to sell the idea to a few people down the line, but we've got it now, so. Lay down, my dear sister, won't you lay it
take your rest. Won't you lay your head upon my Savior's breast? But I love you, but Jesus loves you the best. And I bid you good night, good night, good night. Oh, I bid you good night, good night, good night.
One of these mornings bright and early and fine.
Good night, good night.
Not a creepy, not a soul to slow me down.
Good night, good night.
Oh, I'll be walking in the valley of the shadow of death.
Good night,
good night.
Good night.
He's riding a staff will comfort me.
Good night, good night.
Oh, John, when he saw the sign.
Good night, good night.
Oh, John, say I've seen another sign.
Good night, good night.
I'm telling A for the art, that wonderful poet. Good night, good night. You know the building of the land, getting water to flow. Good night, good night. Tell them B for the beast at the ending of the word. Good night, good night.
You know they ate all the children when they wouldn't be good.
Good night, good night.
And I remember quite well, I remember quite well.
The bad boy of rock and roll, singing the song he'd wanted to sing all his life on the stage, never having felt comfortable in his own skin, and having a bunch of bandmates who thought it utterly ridiculous to sing a song so beautiful. And have you ever heard something so beautiful from Robert Plant? Sometimes you need to be in your 60s to figure out who you are. I bid you good night. Well, we looked it up. We tried to find the writer. There isn't one. Like so many great old gospel songs, it's just a traditional ballad. He had heard it in the hills of Scotland, and how many young people had heard it in the hills of Appalachia? No difference. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories, the life of Robert Plant, his art, his music, and so utterly connected to the American story here on Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib. We'll be right back.
French are glad to die for love. They delight in fighting duels. But I prefer a man who lives and gives expensive jewels. A kiss on the hand may be quite continental, but diamonds are a girl's best friend.
This is Our American Stories. And on this day in history in 1962, an American icon died. You might know her voice. You might know her music. Probably some of her movies. Perhaps you've heard about some of her relationships. And you'll definitely recognize her famous skirt-blowing scene from The Seven-Year Itch. She became an icon of glamour and sensuality, Hollywood's biggest star and American legend. When we hear her name, we instantly think of her idealized marriage. Because she is so iconic, we often forget the tragedy of her life. The world knew her as Marilyn Monroe. But on June 1st, 1926, she was born Norma Jean Mortensen to a paranoid schizophrenic mom, Gladys Pearl Baker. It may not be much of a surprise that Marilyn later struggled with mental illness, since on top of inheriting a heightened genetic risk, young Marilyn bounced between unstable situations throughout her childhood. Her mother, very much unprepared for the role, placed young Marilyn in the care of foster parents while she unsuccessfully pursued a Hollywood career. Throughout her childhood, Marilyn had 13 foster brothers and sisters. Her mother was in and out of her life, and she never knew who to trust as guardians and foster parents. Here's Marilyn herself explaining this confusion that no little girl should ever experience.
One morning, I referred to the woman as Mama, and she said, "I'm not your mother. Don't call me mother anymore. Call me Aunt so-and-so." But the one I was concerned was her husband. I said, "But he's my daddy." And she said, "No."
To further complicate matters, Marilyn's birth mother would take her on outings every now and then, trying to maintain some sort of motherly bond, but depriving Marilyn of the relationship that she really needed most. Some hope for greater consistency came when Marilyn moved into a new home with her mother. Things were looking up, but Marilyn would soon find out that the bumpy ride wasn't over.
We only had the home for about, I don't even think it was 3 months, because she was taken away, my mother.
She had had a mental breakdown, Gladys, and was soon committed to a mental institution. Marilyn, now declared a ward of the state, was fostered to a new couple. Marilyn later hinted at sexual abuse and rape during this time. Soon after, her mother's friend Grace Goddard placed Marilyn into an orphanage.
"I don't want to stay here."
"Oh, it's not going to be for long, I promise."
"When is Mother coming back?"
"Mother's not going to be home for a long time, honey. She's sick."
"But I'm not an orphan."
"I take care of you, but I have to work. There's no one to look after you."
"I can look after myself. Or go back to Aunt Ida's."
"Come get you as soon as I can."
Well, Grace Goddard, 2 years later, took Marilyn out of that orphanage and declared guardianship over her. But that lasted about 6 months, until Doc molested Marilyn. So she was off to another home, this time with Mrs. Goddard's aunt. This proved to be more stable for Marilyn, but she nevertheless struggled with problems that many foster children encounter. Listen to her junior high school teacher explain.
"She was a youngster who looked as though she wasn't well cared for. Her clothes separated her a little bit from the rest of the girls. She was like a little girl, not well developed as some of the youngsters were. She just seemed like a nice child, but not very outgoing and not very vibrant."
And why would she be? She then ran into some more bad luck when her foster mother became ill and Marilyn had to move back in with the Goddards. Though her stay with the Goddards wouldn't last long, and she was yet again threatened with being placed into another orphanage.
"Doc's company's transferring him to Virginia. I want you to come with us, but Doc says that you're too
He doesn't want you with us.
Well, where will I go?
Well, you're too young to be on your own, so just have to go back.
Back where? Oh, Grace, please. Please don't make me go back.
I hate the idea as much as you. There's one other thing I can think of.
What is it? Please, I'll do it, please.
You're 16. That's the legal age. I could talk to Jimmy's mother.
About what?
You could get married.
She was so afraid of returning to that orphanage that the 16-year-old Marilyn agreed to marry her 21-year-old neighbor, James Dougherty. As frightening as this was, it did help jumpstart her entertainment career. At the start of World War II, her husband enlisted into the Merchant Marine. To make extra money and to pass time, Marilyn worked in a munitions factory where she became a part of a morale-boosting photo shoot featuring American women contributing to the war effort. Marilyn befriended the photographer, quit her job, and began modeling. Her agent introduced her to celebrity photographer Laszlo Willinger, who would help propel her career forward.
It was in 1946, Mrs. Snively had a little agency. She called and she said, I have a girl, and I think she might be interesting. So I said, send her over. So a girl came in, nice, but nothing great. So I made some tests of her. From that time on, I used her for years. She had one bad front tooth, which I had fixed at my expense. Her hair was kinky, which someone else fixed. But she was a very good model. I had her on easily 100 magazine covers. Her face and figure was well known long before she became Marilyn Monroe.
While Marilyn embraced the limelight, her husband James resented it. He didn't like to see his wife exposed to the public, and the couple could not reconcile. Around the same time as their divorce in late 1946, Marilyn signed with 20th Century Fox, and this was the birth of her stage name, the one we all know her by.
Well, the camera loves you, sweetheart. You can make a fortune. So here is the deal. $75 a week to be paid, whether we use you or not. Contract is renewable after 6 months at our option. So, Norma Jean Dougherty?
Dougherty.
We need something people can pronounce.
Well, my maiden name is Mortensen.
That's a little long.
What about Monroe? It was her mother's name.
Love it. Marilyn Monroe. How about that? Huh? The alliteration's good.
Okay.
Her first two roles were in The Shocking Miss Pilgrim and Scudahoo, Scudahay, 1948. Surprisingly, the studio declared her unphotogenic and cut out the majority of her scenes. After being dropped by 20th Century Fox and later Columbia Pictures, she posed nude for the now famous calendar shot, which was later to appear in Playboy's first centerfold piece. After the magazine's release, Marilyn broke out into stardom with leading roles in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes and How to Marry a Millionaire. Take a listen to this famous scene between Marilyn Monroe and David Wayne in the aforementioned picture.
You're crazy.
No.
You look better with them on.
I do?
Gives your face a certain mystery.
No kidding.
And distinction, a certain kind of distinction.
Well, what do you know about that?
You're already a very good-looking girl, you know, if you don't mind my saying so.
No, not at all.
And the glasses, that particular type, gives your face a very interesting difference.
You don't think they make me look like an old maid?
I've never seen anybody in my whole life that reminded me less of an old maid.
What's your name?
And when we come back, more on the life story of Marilyn Monroe. So much of this I simply didn't know, and it explains so much. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And on this day in history, in 1962, Marilyn Monroe died.
There is a river called the River of No Return. Sometimes it's peaceful, If you listen, you can hear it call. Whalerie.
Whalerie.
There is a river called the River of No Return. Sometimes it's peaceful, and sometimes wild and free.
This is Our American Stories, the life of Marilyn Monroe. She died tragically. A life ended abruptly and tragically in 1962. And what a childhood she had to endure. She was born again, Norma Jean Mortensen, in 1926. And just, my goodness, bounced around, a life you would want no child to lead. Well, we learn how she got into the business. Her star continued to rise through the early 50s, but she was soon tired of her contract limitations. Marilyn was locked into far lower pay than comparable stars, and she couldn't choose her projects and was blocked from appearing in films other than comedies or musicals. When she refused to start filming yet another musical comedy, the studio suspended her. By then, Marilyn had caught the attention of retired baseball legend Joe DiMaggio a few years earlier, and their relationship attracted constant media attention. Now, with some forced downtime in her hands, Marilyn decided to use all that press to raise her profile and strengthen her bargaining position with the studio. Marilyn and Joe DiMaggio were married in 1954, making the King of Sports and the Queen of Movies one of the most famous couples in the world. Marilyn told reporters that she would be the perfect wife, cooking him meals, even ironing his shirts, and one day raise a family together. The couple honeymooned in Japan, an opportunity that Marilyn used to visit nearby American troops.
Marilyn Monroe arrives in Korea to tour the front lines for 4 days. Hubby Joe DiMaggio is in Japan coaching Japanese baseball teams. Marilyn wears drab GI clothing as she meets the boys. The hills are alive with troops as Marilyn puts on her act. Officers estimate that she plays to about 60,000 men in her first 2 days in Korea. Marilyn is tops. Says she, gosh, I've never seen so many men in my life.
But beware when they start to descend. It's them that don't fly, go back to their spouses. Diamonds are a girl's best friend.
And this was Marilyn's first live performance, and she later described this event as unequaled in her lifetime. Never before, Marilyn said, had she been showered with so much love. By March of 1954, Marilyn had a more favorable contract with Fox, which included a $100,000 bonus for starring in the film version of the Broadway play The Seven-Year Itch. Marilyn sought acting coaches who encouraged her to dig deep into her dark past, reliving the pain from her childhood to make her acting more authentic. At the same time, she started relying on drugs to keep her awake, put her to sleep, and take off the edge. This all disturbed DiMaggio, who had issues of his own, and their marriage began to fall apart. It was this subway scene from The Seven-Year Itch that both immortalized Marilyn and marked the end of her marriage.
Didn't you just love the picture? I did, but I just felt so sorry for the creature at the end.
Sorry for the creature? Why'd you want him to marry the girl?
He was kind of scary looking, but he wasn't really all bad. I think he just craved a little affection, you know, a sense of being loved and needed and wanted.
That's a very interesting point of view.
Oh, do you feel the breeze from the subway? Isn't it delicious?
And that was the iconic scene when Marilyn walked over that subway grate as the winds came up from the vent and blew her dress up, exposing her panties to the crowd of over 2,000 onlookers. This spectacle made Marilyn front page material all over the world. It also marked the start of another round of conflict with the studio and the end of her 9-month-old marriage to DiMaggio. Tired of arguing with the studio over pay and roles, Marilyn decided to start her own company, Marilyn Monroe Productions, because in her words, quote, I want to do better things. People have scope, you know. Around the same time, she began dating the famous playwright Arthur Miller, known for The Crucible and Death of a Salesman. He sought often Marilyn's advice with his plays, which encouraged Marilyn to expand her roles from the comedic dumb blonde to a serious dramatic actress. We first see this transformation in her 1956 movie Bus Stop, her co-star Don Murray. Here he is talking about her performance.
When I first heard that I'd be working with Marilyn Monroe on Bus Stop, my expectations was to be working with a musical comedy actress. Marilyn had learned a tremendous dramatic and comedy technique that didn't depend just on her personality, but she could really get into a character and play it with great truth as well as humor. The last scene in Bus Stop, the last love scene, as a matter of fact, it wasn't the last scene, but the last love scene, where we come together and we have that kiss, when I very seriously say to her, I sure wish you were coming back to the ranch with me, Cherry. I wish that more than anything in the world. And she accepts my proposal. That scene was shot in an extreme close-up.
I still wish you was going back to the ranch with me more than anything I knew.
You do?
Yeah, I do.
Well, I'd go anywhere in the world with you now.
And I remember that scene in particular because Josh Logan, the director, wanted that extreme close-up, and the cinematographer said, you can't do that on CinemaScope because it's too startling to the audience. And Logan said, I don't care. As long as you can get it in focus, I want it. They set it up, and the cinematographer said, the camera's cutting off the top of Don's head. It won't work. And Marilyn said that wonderful, famous line, which she actually said was not a publicist's dream. She said, so what? The audience knows Don has a top to his head. It's been established.
It has. What an insight, by the way. Critics were stunned at this performance, and the press praised her transformation, proclaiming it the best performance of her career. Later, Arthur wrote a dramatic screenplay titled The Misfits as a gift to Marilyn. She would star in it, the very last film she ever completed.
What makes you so sad? I think you're the saddest girl I ever met.
You're the first man ever said that. I'm usually told how happy I am.
That's because you make a man feel happy.
That's Clark Gable, of course. Marilyn wasn't all too pleased with that movie, thinking it looked a bit too much like their crumbling marriage. Meanwhile, she had a miscarriage. Sinking deeper into depression, Marilyn doubled down on the very things that Arthur blamed for losing the baby, drugs and alcohol. During the filming, she had an affair with one of her co-stars and was hospitalized for having a mental breakdown. And to make matters worse, before the film was released, Arthur Miller and Marilyn Monroe got a divorce. Afterward, she committed herself to a psychiatric clinic to try to free herself from drugs. Not long after, Marilyn befriended a socialite named Pat, who introduced Marilyn to her brother, President John F. Kennedy, often called Jack. The next thing you know, JFK invited her to spend the weekend with him at Bing Crosby's house in Palm Springs, California. And the two were clearly intimate.
You know, Jack and I had this immediate connection. I hadn't felt anything like it since I met Joe. And just between you and me, he's going to divorce Jackie. He's going to stay with her until he's reelected. And then you and I, we're going to be much more than just friends.
It sure seemed that way, especially after Marilyn was invited to sing to the president on his birthday.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Mr. President. Happy birthday to you.
Kennedy wasn't in this relationship for the long run. His aides, who were well aware of his various affairs, warned the president to steer clear of the mentally unstable movie star. You might say JFK didn't handle things well. Instead of personally telling Marilyn it was over, the president sent his brother, Attorney General Bobby Kennedy, to tell Marilyn to never call the White House again. This was her tragic tipping point. As Diane Stevens, an employee of Marilyn's publicist, explains, quote, Marilyn was a very obsessive and neurotic person. She was mentally ill, let's face it. She was on drugs and not thinking clearly and just went over the edge when it came to this man. And truly, I do not know why. It had just been a weekend after all. But for some reason, it became, looking back on it now, the catalyst for her total ruination.
This is the secluded Spanish cottage where actress Marilyn Monroe died. Bottle of sleeping pills near her bed.
It is my conclusion that the death of Marilyn Monroe was caused by a self-administered overdose of sedative drugs, and that the mode of death is probable suicide.
Marilyn lived what could be called a modern tragedy, struggling to find her footing in spite of a turbulent childhood, experiencing so much instability and accomplishment, so much adoration and loneliness. She was anything but a simple blonde bombshell. As Marilyn said, quote, "It takes a smart brunette to play a dumb blonde."
Don't you know that a man being rich is like a girl being pretty? You might not marry a girl just because she's pretty, but my goodness, doesn't it help?
Say, they told me you were stupid. You don't sound stupid to me.
I can be smart when it's important, but most men don't like it.
And there you have it. On this day in history, Marilyn Monroe died in 1962. And as always on Our American Stories, this day in history is brought to us by Hillsdale College. And let's close out with Elton John.
Those around to call. They crawled out of the woodwork and they whispered into your brain. They said you are the treadmill and they made you change your name. It seems to me you lived your life like a candle in the wind, never knowing who to cling to when the rain set in.